This is an American Crimecast production. Visit us at our new home at accproductions.org. And remember, everyone is innocent until proven guilty in the court of law.
What's up, you crazy people? This is Boone, and you're listening to Justin Rimmel and Mysterious Circumstances. Enjoy.
I've read Perfume by Patrick Susskind about 10 times in my life. It's about this perfume apprentice in France at the turn of the century, and he is just disgusted basically with all humans, and he just can't get away from humans, so he goes on this trek, this walk of death, where he goes into the rural areas where there's, you know, woods all over the place and the small villages, and he only travels by night. He just, every time he smells human, like a fire from a far off way, you know, he'll just get really disgusted and hide, and he just tries to stay away from people. I kind of relate to that.
He was angry, he was confused, he was resentful, but he just clearly had that total star power.
My father, one time, a few years ago, he wrote me a letter, and he said, you know, if it wasn't for, you know, living in an oppressed town, you know, you wouldn't have had the incentive to really go out and prove something to anyone. And he likes to take credit for that, for bringing me up in a small town. I'm sure I would have looked for punk rock, and it just would have been easier for me, and I would have gotten into it at an earlier age. You know, I just think there's a breed of people who really honestly like music, and there aren't very many of them, really. You know, and those are the people who usually become musicians.
With Teen Spirit as their calling card, Nirvana knocked the reigning king of pop off the top of the charts. Kurt Cobain was king, and Nirvana lay siege to the nation.
I turned on MTV, and there we were. And I was like the Beatles. It's like Nirvana mania. I found it hard. It's hard to find
the well, whatever, never mind. Kurt Cobain was just genuinely one of those freakish talents that only come along once in every great while. And he left the world at his zenith.
Kurt Cobain, the leader of one of rock's most gifted and promising bands, Nirvana, is dead, and this is the story as we know it so far. Cobain's body was found in a house in Seattle on Friday morning. He was dead of an apparently self-inflicted shotgun blast to the head.
For kids like my age, like, we felt like we lost someone that was the most important person in our lives.
I just focus on the fact that he totally changed my life. I mean, he brought real music into the charts and onto the radio.
As far as the music world was concerned, when Kurt died, the air just went out of the room. It's like a silence.
It was a testament and a recognition of what he meant to people and who he was, whether he wanted to be that guy or not. As long as we're having conversations about American cultural history, Kurt Cobain is going to be one of the chapters. He is the face of 90s culture. That's Kurt Cobain. He's the icon of his time.
He left behind amazing music. He transformed forever the idea of what rock and roll could be.
I think that the idea of all that was lost with Kurt Cobain is something that kind of fires the imagination of younger people, I think. Regardless of the suffering that you went through, your life and your music is inspiring other people to create. That's a great gift.
Nirvana is going to be a band that's going to be around forever. For our era, Nirvana was the Beatles.
Nirvana defined a moment, a movement for outsiders, for the fags and the fat girls and the broken toys and the shy nerds and the goth kids from Tennessee and Kentucky, for the rockers and the awkward and the fed up and the too smart kids and the bullied. We were a community, a generation.
And that reminds me of Kurt Cobain. He really connected with a lot of people.
We were a product of a community of youth looking for a connection away from the mainstream. Nirvana tapped into a voice that was yearning to be heard.
You look up to your heroes, and you shouldn't be intimidated by them. You should be inspired by them.
When an artist offers an idea, a perspective, it helps us all to see who we are. It wakes us up, and it pushes us forward towards our collective and individual potential. It makes us, each of us, able to see who we are more clearly, lyrically exposing our frailty, our frustrations, our shortcomings, singing of retreat and acceptance. They spoke truth, and a lot of people listened. And that voice, Kurt, we miss you.
All right, welcome to Mysterious Circumstances. This is Justin. We have a very special episode for you. And before we get started, I would like to give out some dedications. I would like to dedicate this episode to two people. One is Megan Moe, who is an avid podcast supporter. I was lucky enough to meet her and do an interview with her at CrimeCon in the summer. And she is a phenomenal supporter. And just an all-round great, great person. And nobody ever gives her any shout-outs because she's not a podcaster. But she is in my group, and she is very supportive, and she is an extremely lovely lady, and I would like to dedicate this to her. And I would also like to dedicate this to Brittany, who recently informed me that I am in her morning routine when she listens to me on her way to work, and she has been waiting for this episode very impatiently for a long time. So I definitely got to give her a shout out. And this episode is dedicated to you ladies. I do got to say I am joined by three guest hosts today. My good buddy slash sidekick slash I've known him since he was knee high to a duck, Boone. And he did my review show with me. He's a cool dude. And I hear a couple of ladies over there on the other end of the line giggling a little bit. So I got to introduce my other co-hosts. They do a beautiful, absolutely fabulous podcast out of Australia. And they are Sam and Casey from True Crime Storytime.
Thanks for having us.
Yay, we're happy to be here.
I love the compliments too. Thanks for complimenting the show.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't throw out compliments to just anybody, because goddamn it, I'll be critical if I have to. So I am extremely glad that you guys agreed to do this. I know Sam was all about it when I mentioned it probably a month and a half ago, and she's like, oh my God, fuck yeah.
Yeah. Jumped on it straight away.
Casey took a little bit of convincing, because Casey is not so much of a Nirvana and Kurt Cobain fan, which, before we start hearing the boos from the audience, everybody gets into their own music because they can relate to it, because it speaks to them in some way, shape, or form, and you have to fucking respect that as much as you don't like it sometimes. Not saying I don't like it, Casey. Just saying. You know?
I'm not here to hate.
But I do gotta say that on a personal note, you know, what we're gonna do here is the life and death of Kurt Cobain. And the reason that Kurt Cobain meant so much to so many people is because he spoke for the people that didn't have a voice. Like Michael Stipe says, you know, when they get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, he says, you know, he's like, they spoke for, you know, all the gay kids, all the bullied kids, the smart kids. Kurt Cobain was never a person who cared about anybody else's opinion. He did his own thing, and he did it without apology, and he fucking did it 110%. He said everything that you weren't allowed to say, and you never had a platform to say it from. He just screamed it from the top of his lungs, like he was fighting for you. That's why he spoke to so many people, and that's why when he died, it was like a part of you died, because that voice was gone. You know, some people can't relate to music that way. It can literally change your emotions. It can make you happy, it can make you sad, it can make you angry. So with that being said, I would like to ask Sam to go ahead and read a quote that Chris Cornell had, which I'm pretty sure is the best way to put into words how music can relate to people and the death of an artist can relate to people as well.
For people who don't understand why others mourn the death of artists, you need to understand that these people have been a shoulder to cry on, our rock. They've been family, friends, leaders, teachers, and role models. Many have taught us what we need to know and what to do when times get tough. They've helped us move on. They've pushed us out of bed. They've helped us live when nobody else had the time to. Artists have inspired us in endless ways and have been with us through stages in our lives. We've made memories with them. So when they die, a part of us dies.
Very well said. And your voice didn't shake or quiver at all.
Oh, a little.
A little bit.
I tried.
Don't feel bad. I about teared up when I was just like freebasing talking about, well, I can't say freebasing. I shouldn't say freebasing. Yeah. Drug-related episode, trigger words. But why don't you ladies go ahead and plug your podcast. Tell everybody what you're doing nowadays.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, we've just started a new podcast, True Crime Podcast. We mainly focus on Australian cases, maybe the lesser-known ones we're trying to hit on the most. Fortnightly Pod, True Crime Story Time, find us wherever you listen to podcasts.
I know I'm a subscriber, and I like your format. I like the way you present your cases, and I mean, I listen to every episode personally, so... As much as I hate to say it, I don't listen to too many true crime podcasts because there's like 2,000 of them right now.
It is so hard to keep up. I've subscribed to over 100.
But yeah, yours is definitely one of the handful that I tune into every week. And it's very well presented, and I've never heard the cases before. And, you know, like Robert's story that I know I messaged you and I was just like, wow, that was just sad as fuck. It really was, but it was so well told. You ladies pay the respects, and it was very well presented. So, are we ready to have some fun?
Yeah,
I'm ready over here.
Are you ready? No. I'm going to give it the best shot I can.
Yeah. It didn't sound like a super confident yes.
I'm very excited to hear what everyone has to say. Like, yeah. I'm really excited for that. I guess I'm a little nervous because obviously being the least Kurt fan, it's a bit daunting, and I don't want people to think that I'm here just to shit can him, because it's definitely nothing I'm going to do. So I'm here to respect.
Yeah, and like I said before we started recording, when it comes to the psychology of Kurt Cobain and the actual evidence that I'm going to try to present and the coincidences and the circumstances, your opinion as a person who is not a fan, who has a non-biased opinion, is probably going to be the most valuable. So... Even though, you know, you have that opinion of yourself on this side of the microphone, and I know with Sam as well, like, your opinion is going to be extremely valued because my opinion is biased as fuck. This guy was literally one of my fucking heroes, and when he died, I fucking cried my goddamn eyes out. It was like a part of me fucking died. I'm not even gonna lie. As a matter of fact, obviously none of you can see this, but all fucking four of us are wearing flannel right now. Because
hell yeah, we are.
We had to get into it. I'm wearing a fucking shirt with Kurt's face that says I'm not like them, but I can pretend. Boone's wearing a Nirvana t-shirt, you know, because
the smiley face.
This guy was it, man. He was the fucking voice of a generation. And because you are not too familiar with him and not too familiar with the details of the case, your opinion is extremely valued. So don't think for a second that you are not important. You are probably, I hate to say it, probably your opinion is probably going to be the most important out of anybody. Yeah, so.
I think so.
I always try to approach a case with a non-biased opinion, and I try to pride myself on that. I try to look at everything, and I know me and Sam have talked in depth about this over the course of a month and a half. You know, sometimes it's not about proving the theory, but proving a theory wrong. So I think Boone over here is going to start us off. Basically, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the life and death of Kurt Cobain, partly because I love Kurt Cobain and his life should be shared, and secondly, because his life does play a big factor in the psychology of the suicide theory, because he did not have an easy life. He had a pretty fucked up life. He was a troubled kid.
Oh, it always starts at the beginning, right?
Exactly. And he had a very, you know, he had a troubled background and all that stuff. So, Boone, why don't you go ahead and get us started off, man?
Ladies, gentlemen, listeners, thanks again for having me, bud.
Don't thank me, motherfucker. Just get to the case.
Kurt Donald Cobain. born February 20th, 1967, in a town of Aberdeen, Washington. Now, this town was a small town, about 116 miles from Seattle, where the grunge movement really started. Yep. He was very ambitious, very artistic at an early age, but the town itself was, if you weren't logging, you were drinking. You know, this town was...
It was a port town.
Exactly.
It was one of the six largest port cities on the West Coast for logging.
Exactly. What I say, the two things you go to Aberdeen for was for the taverns and the whorehouses. I mean, if you weren't logging, you were drinking. If you were drinking, you were whoring.
Uh-huh. Who were his parents?
Wendy and Donald Cobain. Now, Donald was a mechanic. Now, in a logging town, being a mechanic, he worked at a filling station. Okay, so he, you know, you fill your gas, do this and that and the other, and change your oil, this, that.
Didn't make much money.
No.
He's very, very lower middle class.
And what'd they call it? They call it the hilltop and the low top, right?
Yeah.
Something like that. I can't remember what the exact words were, but the hilltop were the bigger people in this town. Down below was where they obviously wasn't the hilltop, and that's where they lived. And he had a sister, born Kimberly, April 24th, 1970.
Well, before that, he was the pride and joy of the family. He was the center of attention. Shortly after he was born, they did move to, Felony Flats?
I think so, yeah.
Pretty lower middle class. If you look at it now, it looks like a pretty rough neighborhood. It was a two-story house. I believe they paid like $8,000 for the house.
Well, now that there's no logging left.
There's no logging left now, yeah.
It's a pretty low-class neighborhood.
It is. It was a blue-collar, working-class neighborhood, and that's what his parents were. His mom was actually a housewife. She stayed home. You know, she was a housewife, pretty much. And being a mechanic, you know, working at a filling station, his dad really didn't make that much money. So,
well, which in a logging town, I mean...
You ain't gonna, you know, the cost of living's probably pretty low, but at the same time, didn't make much money, so...
Well, his sister was born April 24th, 1970. They got along. The whole family got along.
He was born into a very musical family, too, wasn't he?
Oh, great musical family. Yeah. His uncles, his aunts, his grandmother. Well, he was always artistic.
Oh, yeah.
From kindergarten on. I mean, yeah. From kindergarten, he was drawing, painting, things that were... I mean, even his kindergarten teacher, I think, once said that, I mean, this was the most artistic person I've ever seen for... kindergartner, and it's just a little painting.
Oh, yeah. By the time he was in kindergarten, from the ages like between 5 and 7, he started displaying like an extreme talent for art. I mean, some of his sketches and paintings were literally, if you look at him now, you would not think that a kindergartner would be able to do this shit. And even some of his students in kindergarten, looking back, they would be like, yeah, I remember Kurt Cobain. You know, he was one of those kids that could literally sketch anything that you wanted right there on the spot. And he could just draw it. Yeah. And, I mean, from early on, he was a very artistic kid. If I remember correctly, he was also very, very hyperactive. They had him on Ritalin there for a little while.
I think at 7 years old?
Yeah.
About 7 to 9, I think.
About 7 to 9, they had him on Ritalin, and, they soon took him off of that. But, what else you got?
Which to me, I mean, 7 to 9 years old, you start them on drugs. Right there.
Yeah, and you know, in later years, he blamed that for opening the gate to some of his drug use. You know, whether it was an excuse or not, you know, you can go back and forth with that all day.
And we'll get into that later.
And we'll get into that later. But Kurt himself often said... You know, this is what opened the door for me was my early, you know, Ritalin use, because he had that feeling.
He was quoted as saying he had a great family history. I mean, before the divorce and stuff, but we'll get to later, He loved his family, didn't have a damn thing to say about him other than he hung out with his sister, he liked drawing, his mom and dad were together, this, that, and the other. This lasted for a while. Nothing was wrong with his family.
No, they were a pretty happy run-of-the-mill family, to be honest with you.
I think Kurt only had an issue like when his younger sister was born, because he was so used to being the center of attention. So he adored her, but I've read reports that like he would dote on her and sing her songs, because he became musical at such a young age, along with his drawing. He would just bash on things, and you know, I'm pretty sure I heard a story about him making up a song about going to the park. So he was already artistic in all forms. But yeah, when his sister was born, yeah, he sort of felt like he was the center of everyone's attention, and he lost a little bit of that. So there were at times, I think I read somewhere, that he would occasionally like snatch toys from her because he wanted people to watch him use them. I think that's something that all kids do. But yeah, I think losing that attention at the start, it progressed a lot throughout his life as well. I think that was something that he struggled with.
I agree.
Well, you're exactly right, because what was it, when he had his first drum set, what, 2 years old?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he was banging his drums and doing pretty decent at it. Mm-hmm. And his artistic level obviously made him more prone to be musical. I mean, he has musical background, and his family is amazing.
It's very solid.
If you look at his musical background, his family, his uncles, his aunts, and everything, it is absolutely amazing. And like she stated, when his sister came along, obviously it did change things, because as you will learn later on in his podcast, he was a very emotional, close-knit kind of person that needed to be close to somebody at all times.
Yeah.
And that's a very good point that she just pointed out, because, I mean, not that he didn't love his sister, but he wanted to be loved constantly.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. He needed the affection.
Exactly. Not only that, but he wanted to give the affection to all the other people.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and
yeah, I agree.
That, I think, plays a significant role in all of this. But, I guess to that point, you get a sister, and like you said, it kind of takes away from the attention to you.
Mm-hmm.
It draws away from things, but it goes on for, 9 years?
Yeah, till he's about 9.
Yes, and
his mom says she wants a divorce from his dad, and of course he's totally dumbfounded, he's blindsided by it, and from what we understand from a lot of the things that we heard and read, and I mean, it's obviously varying, but for the most part, her boyfriend right after pretty much made twice the money that Kurt's dad did. And I hate to put the superficial pin on his mother, but when you start looking at it, that's kind of what it came down to. She wanted more security, which is...
Where am I most comfortable?
Which is, yeah, where am I most comfortable? You know, where am I going to have a little bit less stressful, easier life? And I mean, in a way, it's totally understandable. But at the same time, it's like, you know, maybe you could pick up a part-time job, maybe help out a little bit. But it wasn't like that for her. So she filed for divorce. His dad moved out. To a small trailer park.
Yeah, what was that?
Monticello? No, it was Montesano, Washington. And it was a few months after the divorce, Kurt ended up going to live with him, because at the time, it was a little bit different from what it is now. In America, specifically in the state of Indiana, I can't speak for other states, but in Indiana, it's a mother state. It almost doesn't matter if the mother is a drug addict. It doesn't matter if the mom is a convicted felon. 95% of the time,
you're going to mama.
You're going to mom's house. Mom will get full custody almost all the time. And back then,
especially back then,
it was the boys went with the father. You know, some of the girls went with the mother. Do you have anything to add before we...
I was just going to say, when you said how Kurt moved in with his dad, originally I think staying with his mum, I think from everything I've read, deep down, that's where he just always wanted to be. He just wanted to be at home with his mum. But he hated the people that his parents dated, and he didn't cope well with the divorce at all. So, and during the time, like in the town where he was, divorce wasn't all that common, and he held a lot of resentment towards anyone who stepped in front of him, in a sense, like anyone who was dating his parents. So yeah, his mother, Wendy, said once in an interview that she noticed his personality change dramatically after the divorce, and he became more defiant and withdrawn. And Kurt actually made a statement about his feelings on the divorce, saying, "I remember feeling ashamed for some reason. I was ashamed of my parents. I couldn't face some of my friends at school anymore because I desperately wanted to have the classic typical family, mother and father. I wanted that security." So he resented his parents for quite a few years because of that. And yeah, he just wanted to be accepted and prioritized. And I don't think he got that with his mom.
Around this time is when he first started developing his first stomach problems. He was was taken into the doctor. I can't remember if he was hospitalized or not, for malnutrition. And that was the first sign of his stomach problems. So, it did have an impact.
Do you think his stomach problems were a real, is this too early to ask, but do you think it was caused by stress and like his experience at the time? Or do you think it was a real thing?
To be honest with you, like all throughout his life, he would always state that, you know, the gastrointestinal specialists could never pinpoint exactly what was wrong with him. So that would lead me to believe personally that it was more stress related than anything else. But I'm no medical doctor. I'm no psychiatrist or anything like that. Me personally, I've had a lot of problems with crack that beer, bro. You ain't gotta be quiet. For me personally, I've had a lot of those problems too, just with like ulcers and stuff like that. But obviously, if it was an ulcer, doctors would have been able to pinpoint that. It's a pretty run-of-the-mill
standard.
It's pretty standard, you know. So
we'll get in.
I would assume that it's stress related, but I can't really say for sure. What do you think?
I don't know. I sway. Like sometimes I think it is stress related. But then other times I think back then, was Crohn's disease even a thing?
Hey, my brother-in-law has Crohn's.
Yeah. I don't know if it was that well known, and like the pain and the fact that he wasn't receiving nutrients. I'm pretty sure that one of those things attributed to Crohn's is that your gut, you're not absorbing all the nutrients from the food you're
eating. That's it. You have an underdeveloped gut. So it rejects certain types of food.
Yeah. That's just
that's actually really, really good.
There's tons of theories on what could be the problem and what could have been the problem. I mean,
stomach, yeah.
And it was constant throughout his whole life, wasn't it? Like, it didn't stop at all.
Right. It set off at around the time of his parents, at around that stressful time period of his parents' divorce.
Yeah.
But it became more of an issue for him, yeah. I guess. I don't know. Sometimes it was an excuse for his drug use. So it was a bigger issue then, as sort of.
Yeah, so he could medicate the pain that he was feeling. Okay.
Yeah, and we'll get into that later. And I think a lot of people think that and said openly that it was an excuse. It was a lie. It was an excuse. It was an escape. And we don't know. Nobody can tell. Nobody can say anything, you know. But obviously, well, that comes in factor later.
Plays a big factor.
Actually, for his whole life.
No, but it's not really jumping the gun because it is something that had to be addressed now. This is when it started. So we're definitely not jumping the gun. It was something that definitely did have to be addressed, you know,
And it could have started. I mean, as soon as they divorced and he had to go live with his dad, sister was with mom. That's a split family right there. Depression starts. Anxiety starts. Stomach problems start. It's a good plausibility that it started right there. Yeah. I mean, you can't deny that the pain started there.
Oh, yeah.
Plus all the fighting that he had going on with his mom.
Well, that's exactly right. You're living in a home that is that constant stress and strain, and he's fighting with his mom. I mean, he really didn't approve of the way she was living her life after the divorce. His mom was drinking heaps more, and she was going out and dating a lot, which he didn't like. He didn't like it at all. Because of these things, he had enough and decided he was going to go live with his dad. So he moved with his dad, and he moved on to his paternal grandparents as well. Iris and Leland. Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
Bounty
hunter. Okay.
Sorry. Okay. No, I was like, I saw that and I thought, oh yeah, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. Iris and Leland.
That's it. So it wasn't a bad thing because Kurt was very close with his grandmother, Iris. She really supported and strengthened his love of art. She encouraged him and really pushed that because she was an artist herself. Kurt was spoiled throughout his childhood, and that didn't change when he moved in with his dad. They did everything together. Don bought him a mini bike as a gift, and they spent a lot of time together riding. Kurt was happy. In fact, it was probably the happiest he'd been until his dad, you know, was remarrying and stuff.
Yeah, he actually asked his dad during that time. He was so happy with the bond they had and the attention that he was getting that he made his dad promise not to remarry, which obviously, yeah.
It's kind of sad, but it's sad. It's this sweet little child-like mentality that it's, this is my dad, this is making me happy.
Yeah,
I need to keep this.
Yeah, he didn't want to lose that bond. And his mum, she eventually did meet a man. His name was Frank. Kurt fucking hated Frank. And it's no wonder he didn't like Frank because Frank used to get drunk a lot with Wendy. They'd get pissed all the time. They'd have massive fights. And there was this one time that Kurt was actually there and he saw Frank abuse his mum and break her arm. And so he wanted to visit. He wanted to go and be at his mum's place, but he couldn't be there because that Frank guy was there. And she stood by him too throughout the whole thing. She wouldn't press charges and she stayed in that relationship. She was like committed to that relationship. So that was like another barrier between him being able to go home to where he really wanted to be.
Another story about that Frank guy too. He hated Kurt's dad to the point where there is a story of Kurt's dad's license getting sent to that house.
Renewed license.
His renewed license. And Frank literally wiped his ass with it and then forwarded it to him. So if
just
that,
because it had...
Just because it was Kurt's dad. And he literally wiped his ass with it, put it back in an envelope, and forwarded it to him. You know, if that doesn't tell you a little bit about that situation, I don't know what does. The guy was a fucking asshole.
Yeah, I feel sorry for Donald because he never wanted... He never wanted to have his marriage end. Wendy just, it was like she just didn't love him anymore and she just ended it. And
which is, yeah, really, really sad because he ended up being super lonely. He really, really wanted his family or at least a family. He wanted to meet someone and once he started putting himself out there, he actually met a woman named Jenny Westby. Kurt seemed to really like Jenny at first. She gave him the maternal attention he was craving. Jenny, however, already had two kids of her own, 9-year-old Mindy and 5-year-old James. So at least she knew a thing or two about parenting, which is really good.
Yeah, that's what he needed.
However, it didn't last because when they all moved in together, that's when Kurt's feelings changed. He had to share his dad again. He had to share that attention not just with her but with the two kids. And on top of that, in 1979, they had a baby boy, his half-brother Chad. So, again, that time split once more.
Yeah, that's more attention. You know, it sounds bad wording it that way, but it's exactly what it was. It's more attention that he wasn't getting.
Yep.
And he was such a sensitive soul. So he needed
that positive reinforcement. Yeah. He needed that reinforcement.
Yeah. And there were different rules in this house as well, rules that Kurt had to follow. Maybe bullshit rules like a curfew or chores. I mean, even as an adult, I hate chores. But, so he butted heads with Don and Jenny over this and he was a slob to the point of rebellion. Like he rebelled against hygiene and it was justified in his mind because he felt like they would be more severe when punishing him. So it was just his way of getting their back attention at them. Yeah. So he felt like they were always harder on him and that all his siblings would get more attention. But I think the most difficult part in all of this for Kurt was he felt like his dad would always side with Jenny, his new stepmom, and he'd never step up to defend him. And Don actually admits that he did do this because he was afraid of another divorce. This new family, which Kurt insisted was not his real one. He would never say that that was his real family. It was in stark contrast to the attention he was used to receiving as a young boy. And his resentment towards his stepmom was just too big to hide. And Kurt would just escape through his art and He'd always be drawing or writing in his journals and always creating. He was given a Super 8 video camera as a gift. I can't remember who it was from. It could have been his Aunt Mary. But, yeah, anyway, he was given that and he started to create movies. And some of these movies, some people would say, are focused on darker topics. So when Kurt was only 14, a friend of his told him he should be an artist. And he responded with, "I'm going to become a superstar musician, kill myself, and go out in a flame of glory." He said that at only 14 years old. And suicide was a continuous theme with Kurt. He actually made a short film on that very same camera titled "Kurt Commits Bloody Suicide," where he cuts his wrists with a Coke can and just he like smothered himself in fake blood to make it extra gory.
And people would even say that Kurt had a history of suicide within his family.
Mm. I think that can be disputed though, because when Kurt died, Courtney Love jumped on the whole suicide angle and she hit it hard. She said in several interviews that she immediately gave after Kurt's death that he was like the third or maybe fourth person in his family to commit suicide, calling it the Cobain curse. But I've seen Kurt's grandfather's brother shot himself, and another one of those brothers, I think, also killed himself after he lost his wife. But then in another version of these events, it didn't seem to go down that way. His grandfather's brother, who shot himself, apparently did so by accident. Have you heard this theory?
No, I have not. But I am super intrigued.
Yeah, apparently he was a police officer and he dropped his gun and it fired and shot him. And he jumped up straight away to ask everyone if they were okay. He didn't even realize that he'd been shot. And then he just hit the floor and died. And the other man who died apparently had a brain aneurysm and fell down the stairs. And he was told, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to die. And he didn't stop. So he did die. And if these stories are the truth, then I think that doesn't really qualify to me as a suicide curse, but more of a curse of addiction. And that's one thing with Kurt's story. It's so freaking hard to get the straight facts on it.
Which is plausible as hell. Yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah, another experience that Kurt had, sorry to ramble on, but this one was major, I think, with suicide, and it was really full on. He went to school one day with a couple of his friends and they saw a young student who had killed himself. He'd hung himself. And I think one of the friends he was with was actually that student's brother. And apparently Kurt didn't even really react, like he wasn't panicked. He didn't react at all, really. He just stood there kind of fascinated. And eventually adults came and discovered the grisly scene and sent Kurt and his friends away. But apparently this experience really fueled his fascination and like borderline obsession with suicide. And after this, he would often joke about how he had suicide genes. And he would
absolutely
promote that a lot.
That's well, it exactly sticks with you.
Yeah.
Especially a young kid. I mean, the younger you are, the more it sticks with you, I think. Someone our age.
Well, these are in the formative years.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Your brain's still developing. Your everything around you, it all makes a really lasting impression, especially when you're at that age. And I always thought it's sad that his reaction was just so disconnected.
Like a non-reaction.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, like I heard the same thing. Like him and two of his friends literally stood there until the people at the school told him.
Get away.
You know, said, you know, they had to remove him. They stood there and stared at the body for anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes from what I understand.
See, this I hadn't heard. Well, most of this stuff I hadn't heard. But this one, when Samantha told me this when we were talking about it, that one really stuck with me. Like, to stand there and stare at a dead body and be next to somebody or near somebody whose family that is and have no reaction but just kind of
fascination.
Absolute fascination with what is in front of him. That, for me, that's really interesting, and it kind of paints a picture of potentially the things that are going on in his mind. And I don't want to get all English teacher on you, but, you know, kind of foreshadows the things that could come and the depth of, you know, who his soul really is.
But Casey, you also dabble in criminology as well, don't you?
Mm-hmm. I do.
What do they have any kind of relation to that in criminology whatsoever? Like maybe the younger parts of forming of the brain of like a criminal or a serial killer or something like that. Is there anything that might relate to that?
It's funny that you say that because the topic that I'm doing at the moment, look, it's just an introductory topic, but I'm really looking at the moment, the different theories behind criminology and who is a criminal and what makes somebody commit a crime. And some of those theories touch on that and the psychology behind a person and their experiences. Is it nature versus nurture? And absolutely, it is spoken about and really discussed as something that really can send you on that path of, you know, becoming a criminal or let's say a serial killer. But we know Kurt didn't, but it kind of puts you on that path along those sorts of lines to be so susceptible.
So it can contribute to some of those
yep.
actions in the future, yep. your experiences.
Yep.
Okay.
That's really, really interesting because sure I think part of it was, I think around this time is where his uncle for his birthday, I believe it was his birthday, correct?
Gave him a choice.
Gave him a choice on whether to get a bike
motorbike
or guitar. And he chose a guitar. I don't want to say that might have contributed to him not going down the criminal path because he did get in trouble. He was a fucking huge rebel.
Well, and this was after he moved back in with his mom.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, he was there. I think
he was back and forth.
I think he was at his dad's till what, like 82? Because he hated his stepmom and their kids.
Oh, yeah.
Dad always took her side, obviously, this, that, and the other. I mean,
normal shit.
He was a very sensitive human being, like we already said.
When you're an artistic person, you're naturally going to be sensitive.
Yeah.
There's a certain type of person that has that artistic.
Yeah.
I think for the most part, I read, after that, he bounced around quite a bit from relative to relative.
Yeah. I can't remember which one exactly. It was between 6 months and a year. He went from 10 different homes.
Yeah, he was pretty much just couch surfing a lot of the time.
This auntie, that auntie, the grandparents, some friends.
Yeah. Yeah, just anyone that would take him. And then if he couldn't find a couch, he claimed that he slept under a bridge. But I think that's been disproven just because of the environment of the bridge. It's just sludge. It's just like mud under there and freezing cold. So he would go into, apartment buildings and just sleep in the hallways of apartment buildings. Or he'd spend his days in the hospital room, hospital, like waiting rooms, and like try and steal food from trays in the canteen. Do you guys call it a canteen or the cafeteria? He would steal meals that way, and it was just a place with a couch and a TV and a warm place for him to be.
And a roof over his head.
Yeah, pretty sad.
Well, the whole reason why he went to hospital waiting rooms is you go to a hospital waiting room, you get in a chair and you fall asleep. Nobody's going to come up to you asking you, why are you here?
Nobody's going to question
you. Yeah, no one's going to tell you to move along.
I'm waiting on my dying uncle.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah.
Why would you ask me that question? I mean, it was actually pretty freaking brilliant. He needed a place to stay. I mean, Jesus.
And his whole life, it just went from like the perfect family. Well, no family's perfect, but his idea of the perfect family to it all dissolving in a day. And then he had to hunt out a place to sleep and hunt out his meals. And so by like the eighth grade, Kurt was using LSD and smoking pot. And it was just a way for him to self-medicate. And by ninth grade, he'd formed an addiction to marijuana and was smoking it every single day. And he refused to do his homework and he just wasn't doing well at school, except, of course, art class. That was the only class that he would try in. I mean, he didn't really stick to the assigned work, but he was involved. He really enjoyed it. And, that was the only exception for him at school. And when he started high school, I think it was in 81, he seemed to try a lot harder at first. So he joined the football team and he quit when he realized how much work it actually was. He was also in the wrestling team and he began to just throw the matches though, because he knew that his dad was watching and it would piss him off. And his mum, Wendy, said that the only reason that Kurt ever really took part in sports was to try and please his father, but he obviously didn't care about pleasing him for long because he ditched all the sports and he took up a new hobby, and that hobby stayed with him for the rest of his life. And that's, yeah, it was around, I think, when you mentioned his Uncle Chuck, I think it was that birthday where he asked him, what would you prefer, a bike or a guitar? And obviously he picked the guitar.
That is correct.
His dad pushed him to play sports. So he's like, yeah, I will. And he was actually a very good wrestler with no experience. And in practice, he would be exceptional. And in the match, he would intentionally get pinned. He would lay down and roll over and get pinned just to piss his dad off.
What a smart ass.
It's really interesting because it really seems like this guy had so much talent in so many different areas. Like, he oozed talent. Whatever he touched, he could do. This is how it seems to me. Like, wrestling, doesn't matter what it is, art, music, sport, he just was good at it.
But he wanted to show that he was like, you know what? I'm going to lay down here, piss off.
Well, that's right. Like, when he was in high school, he not only, you know, was on the sports teams and, you know, trying different things out, but he started this new persona, you know, kind of, he wasn't shy anymore. He was trying to put himself out there. He decided he was going to be loud and funny, and he actually became quite popular and girls took notice. Like, he...
Blonde hair, blue eyes, girls.
Samantha and I will. He's not an ugly guy, right?
Blonde hair, blue eyes.
Broody. Like, so Kurt's off to see his first concert at the age of 16, and in typical Kurt style, he decides to tell everyone that the first band he went to see was a group called Black Flag. But in reality, it was actually Sammy Hagar. So from this, it wasn't until about 1983 that he discovered punk rock, his love, okay? And in the summer of 1983, he went to see the Melvins, and they became his idols. He changed his appearance. He grew his hair long, started wearing a trench coat with tennis shoes, and he spent most of his days getting drunk or stoned with his friends.
Yeah, and in about 87, he formed a new band, and they played their first gig at a house party. They performed an original song called Downer, and of course Kurt wrote that.
Of course.
And Kurt was drunk. Chris was drunk, Chris Novoselic, because he was already in the band. We haven't covered that, but yeah. Chris was drunk and Kurt was nervous, but it was all still worth watching because Kurt was so intense, like he always was with his performances, and everyone loved it. Kurt left Aberdeen that year with his girlfriend Tracy, because they just met that year. And Tracy was real supportive. She worked nights and paid for everything Kurt needed while he was unemployed, and spent his days writing and playing guitar constantly and doing artwork. And his only job in the house, by the way, was the housework. And he was really shit at it. Tracy used to have to leave him like detailed to-do lists because he just couldn't do any of it.
I really like a to-do list. That'll get me through my task. So I can feel you on that one, Kurt. But
good touch.
I can't. Yeah, that's just me. Kurt's band was performing at heaps of college parties in Olympia. They recorded their first demo in 1988. They were in the studio for 6 hours and recorded 9.5 songs, but didn't want to pay the extra $20 for the extra half an hour to finish that final song.
And it was the same. It was the same studio that Mudhoney and Soundgarden had recorded at as well.
So pretty legendary shit going on right there.
Yeah.
It is, isn't it, right? Imagine playing in the same places, people like Soundgarden.
But it was Nirvana.
He looked up to Mudhoney and Soundgarden and the groups like that in Seattle. I mean, he was
on the Melvins. He was what they called a Klingon. Yeah. Like, the Melvins called them Klingons. Like, in reference to Star Trek, and because they just cling to him, you know what I mean? Yeah, that's actually where he met Chris Novoselic.
And that's where it was his brother.
Yeah.
And obviously they were boozing and drinking and doing drugs and this and that. I mean, him and his first girlfriend, they were the rock and roll style couple. They had no money. They lived together. The only thing that kept them together was rock and roll.
Well, they had money because Tracy literally carried the fucking weight.
She like, did
as
everything.
Much, as much as I love Kurt, he literally freeloaded off
she
of Tracy.
She did everything. She would work.
She would constantly bitch about it, but he would stay home, watch TV, write songs, you know, all this draw good stuff. Yeah.
And he would do his art.
Yeah, he was doing his art. And actually, the song Smells Like Teen Spirit actually came from Tracy, one of her friends, who I believe was in Bikini Kill, right?
Well, that was a girl's deodorant at that point in time. It was called, like, what, Teen Spirit or some shit?
I don't think that was
And, well, it was Tracy's friend who wrote Kurt Smells Like Teen Spirit on one of the walls.
In his apartment.
In their apartment. And that's pretty much...
And he just took it like, oh, that's funny.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, he didn't really care.
Yeah. I think the first love song that he officially wrote about a girl was mm-hmm. about Tracy.
It
and
was.
And he talks in there a little bit about, you know, living for free off her.
Yeah, pretty much.
Basically. And in the end, he was kind of a dick to her. He would isolate himself and almost dare people to reject him. Because then it's not like they left because he was being who he is. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yes.
So yeah, I think in the end, he actually cheated on Tracy while he was on tour somewhere, while he was playing somewhere. And he just told her to sort of force her hand at ending it with him. That's just the way he rolled, I guess.
Yeah. And Tracy, she put up with a lot of shit, but you know, at the end of the day, man, I mean, she saw the inside of Kurt. As opposed to what he was putting out as a front, you know, because he was trying to be this certain persona. He was, you know, in a band, he was trying to be this certain type of guy. But I think she saw him for what he truly was. And I think that's why she kind of, I don't want to say let it happen, but I think that's why she kind of tolerated it. Because she's like, I know you're not this guy, you know, I know you.
She liked the mothering side of Kurt.
Yes.
She seen him with kittens and puppies and stuff like that.
She saw the part of Kurt that he wouldn't let not very many people see.
Yes.
And she appreciated that side of him, the sensitive side, the artistic side.
I agree.
And I think that's part of why she, you know, kind of tolerated some of the bullshit that, you know, he put
But I'm pretty through. Sure she are also went on record, like, yes, I know. He was great with this, that, and the other. But she also ran a record that he was unstable.
No, I think it was around this time that he was actually getting into heroin as well. He had tried heroin for the first time. He had wrote about it in his diary, and he had actually told Chris Novoselic about it. And, you know, Chris had the natural reaction like, hey, man, what the fuck did you just do? Like, you need to walk away from this shit.
Stop.
You stop now before, you know, this was your first time, you know, and Kurt was like, you know, I really liked it, you know, he's like, I can't help it, I really liked it. So, not to defend Courtney Love too much, but there's a lot of people out there who accuse her of getting Kurt Cobain into heroin. That is not the truth.
I don't think it's true.
He was into heroin before he had even met Courtney Love. You know, funny little side fact, you know, he had met Courtney Love long before they had actually gotten together.
Boy.
She was with another musician, and she did, you know, kind of latch on to him a little bit early on. She, you know, Heart Shaped Box is actually about Courtney Love had brought him, like, a gift, and it was in a heart-shaped box.
But, I mean... His first band was Fecal Matter.
Was Fecal Matter, yep.
Well, here's the best part, is Nirvana was almost called Whisker Biscuit. Do you ladies know what Whisker Biscuit is? It's, I'm going to sign you guys this so nobody else can hear it. So Nirvana was almost called Fecal Matter and or Whisker Biscuit. And
it was really cool. He wrote a lot of songs from Nevermind in time period.
Jesus Christ, there's so many songs that he wrote that, I mean, from the very beginning that didn't see a release till later on in life. It's amazing what he did. Fecal Matter had no gigs, by the way. They had no gigs.
Oh, no.
All I did was record some songs in his aunt's basement house. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. But where Nirvana came from was he was watching something on Buddhism,
and they had mentioned Nirvana being Euphoria, the ultimate perfect everything. And he was like, that's it. You know, that's what I want to fucking call it. So, jumping forward a little bit, we're going to skip, you know, a few years, because this isn't about record deals. This isn't about when he signed with Sub Pop. This isn't about that shit.
You got a sense of his background.
This is about his life. We got a sense of his background. We're going to move on to the investigation of it, of his death and the days surrounding it. They were in Europe when Nirvana actually got really big, when they hit the top 40.
And that is where we end part one. Join me for part two, where we dive in deep to try to figure out if there's any rock solid, concrete information out there that might suggest that Kurt Cobain was in fact murdered and did not commit suicide. But before that, I would like to leave you with the last unspoken words from Kurt Cobain. And this is the contents of the note that was found with his body. Speaking from the tongue of an experienced simpleton who obviously would rather be an emasculated, infantile complainee, this note should be pretty easy to understand. All of the warnings from the Punk Rock 101 courses over the years since my first introduction to the, shall we say, ethics involved with independence and the embracement of your community has proven to be very true. I haven't felt the excitement of listening to, as well as creating music, along with reading and writing, for too many years now. I feel guilty beyond words about these things. For example, when we're backstage and the lights go out and the manic roar of the crowds begin, it doesn't affect me in the way in which it did for Freddie Mercury, who seemed to love, relish in the love and adoration from the crowd, which is something I totally admire and envy. The fact is, I can't fool you, any of you. It simply isn't fair to you or me. The worst crime I can think of would be to rip people off by faking it and pretending as if I'm having 100% fun. Sometimes I feel as if I should have a punch-in time clock before I walk out on stage. I've tried everything within my power to appreciate it, and I do. God, believe me, I do, but it's not enough. I appreciate the fact that I and we have affected and entertained a lot of people. I must be one of those narcissists who only appreciate things when they're gone. I'm too sensitive. I need to be slightly numb in order to regain the enthusiasms I once had as a child. On our last three tours, I've had a much better appreciation for all the people I've known personally and as fans of our music, but I still can't get over the frustration, the guilt, and empathy I have for everyone. There's good in all of us, and I think I simply love people too much. So much that it makes me feel too fucking sad. The sad little, sensitive, and appropriate Pisces Jesus man. Why don't you just enjoy it? I don't know. I have a goddess of a wife who sweats ambition and empathy, and a daughter who reminds me too much of what I used to be, full of love and joy, kissing every person she meets because everyone is good and will do her no harm. And that terrifies me to the point to where I can barely function. I can't stand the thought of Francis becoming the miserable, self-destructive death rocker that I've become. I have it good, very good, and I'm grateful. But since the age of 7, I've become hateful towards all humans in general, only because it seems so easy for people to get along that have empathy. Only because I love and feel sorry for people too much, I guess. Thank you all from the pit of my burning, nauseous stomach for your letters and concern during the past years. I'm too much of an erratic, moody baby. I don't have the passion anymore, and so remember, it's better to burn out than to fade away. Peace, love, empathy, Kurt Cobain. Francis and Courtney, I'll be at your altar. Please keep going, Courtney, for Francis, for her life, which will be so much happier without me. I love you. I love you.